and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. The NTSB has learned more about the private plane that crashed into a U.S. Navy neighborhood in San Diego. Investigator Dan Baker.
The airplane was not equipped with a flight data recorder. We are trying to determine at this time if the airplane was equipped with a cockpit voice recorder.
The Justice Department will not move forward with a criminal prosecution of a major airplane manufacturer. Here's KIRO radio reporter Heather Bosch from Seattle.
The DOJ won't prosecute Boeing over the deadly crashes of two MAX planes 6 years ago. Boeing promises to pay $1.1 billion in fines.
President Trump today threatened 25% tariffs on smartphones and 50% tariffs on European Union goods starting June 1st. From Brussels, the BBC's Nick Beek.
I think a lot of companies, particularly in the automobile sector, will be looking at this really, really carefully and with some concern if this is a threat which will be carried through.
CBS News Brief. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Hi, this is Beth, host of The Kitchen's Open. Join us each Monday morning at the top of the 10 o'clock hour for tips, tricks, and a whole lot of fun. The Kitchen's Open, only on WFHR.
A big night for yelling. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball, the Brewers managed to get a win despite a long rain delay. They beat the Pittsburgh Pirates 8-5. Christian Yelich, who was just 2-for-34 in his last at-bats, hit two home runs with four runs batted in to break out of his slump.
Yeah, I mean, it feels good. Pretty tough start to the year and been grinding, and but it's part of the game, you know. And, you know, these guys have been trying to pick me up all year with finding ways to score runs, and nice to see some stuff pay off.
NFL, after a week of team workouts, it's the Packers' annual softball game tonight, started by Brett Favre, then hosted by Donald Driver, and now Jordan Love.
We're excited. My second year, kind of helping run the show. I know last year Donald was a big part of it, and he kind of passed the torch, which was pretty cool. So it's going to be 25th anniversary is pretty special. Obviously, the game's been going on for a long time, so to be able to, you know, take the torch and kind of just carry it and keep it going.
That's Packers quarterback Jordan Love with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
All across Wisconsin, destination marketing organizations are working to ensure that tourism in our state and your local community is stronger than ever. Their work to drive visitation and enhance the visitor experience not only encourages travelers to discover our great state, it bolsters the economy, supports jobs, and it improves the quality of life for all Wisconsin residents. To learn more about what these great organizations are doing, visit DestinationsWisconsin.com. Sponsored by Destinations Wisconsin.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. So on Thursday, the big beautiful bill, the big beautiful disaster passed the House. And in true GOP fashion, they did it like thieves in the night. But for me, the big story, the big story that I want to start with was, his name's Frank Bisignano, a former Wall Street executive turned Trump Social Security head. This is one of those things where you can't make it up. So I want to read Frank Bisignano's statement that was reported in the newspaper. ABC News reported that he said, quote, "So I get a phone call and it's about Social Security. And I'm really not, I swear, I'm not looking for a job. And I'm like, well, what am I going to do?" He says, "So I Google Social Security. You know, one of my great skills, I'm one of the great Googlers on the East Coast." And he added that, I'm like, what the heck's the Commissioner of Social Security? He's the guy they just swore in to be the head of the Social Security Administration. Guy who had to Google what Social Security is. That's indicative of what this administration is doing to our government. And look, you go down the list. Who's that moron, the former governor of South Dakota? What's her, Christy Nothing? Thinks habeas corpus is the the opposite of what it actually is. She's the one in charge of Department of Homeland Security. So top to bottom, they've put people in the positions. RFK Jr. At Health and Human Services? Seriously? Again, they've put people in these positions, not because they're good at what they do, but because they're loyal and they're going to destroy what they lead. Now, the big, beautiful disaster. Because it is. It's a disaster. And really, Republicans who, for years, have screamed about debt and deficits and about fiscal responsibility, or at least, you know, played like they cared. I think it was best summed up by Ralph Norman, the Republican from South Carolina, when asked, you know, why he voted for the budget disaster that he didn't like. And had a Democrat moved it, I guarantee you would have voted against it. But he said, look, the president has a lot of power. And that is it. Trump did a whole bunch of arm twisting, did a whole bunch of give them whatever they want kind of. You remember the pork? Yeah, there was a lot of this and that too. But I do find one of my favorite Republicans, Chip Roy, who's always good for a bit of contradictory hypocrisy. He said he voted in favor of the reconciliation package, but he's not done fighting. He's not done fighting. He said, everybody get ready, because we're going to do some red lines this time, not now, but down the road, we're going to line, and it might be red-ish. You go, really? Is that what you're going with? You're going with, yeah, I voted for it, but you know, I'm going to fight. I'm going to fight it. Ron Johnson said that he's not going to be swayed by Donald Trump. No, Trump's not going to twist his arm because he's irresponsible. He said, you know, in the House, President Trump can threaten a primary. Those guys want to keep their seats. And he said, I understand pressure. Can't pressure me that way. Oh, really? One of the guys who in this bill is going to win? One of the richest guys in the U.S. Senate? Yeah, right. The only person I got to tell you that I really have some respect for, it, and I don't like Rand Paul at all. I don't like his politics. I don't really like him, to be honest with you. But at least he's consistent. He's the one guy who you go, yeah, I get it. He says he's no. He said no because his quote was, I think if you're going to raise the debt ceiling $4 or $5 trillion, it indicates that the project afoot isn't going to fix the deficit at all. He said, once Republicans vote for this, Republicans are going to own the deficit. And he's right. He is spot on right. And understand, they told us, Trump told us, and Republicans told us they were going to fix the debt. They were going to fix the deficits. They were going to be fiscally responsible. They were bringing back, you know, all kinds of great stuff. They were going to make budgets go away. And here's this. And understand, look, this is a bad bill. It's bad top to bottom for the most part. And the Republicans in the Senate are promising to rewrite some of it. And look, it may not pass. It's not going to pass in the form it's in now. We know that. But there's a lot here. And a lot. And this is a giant gift for Democrats. For in 2026, Democrats don't even really have to put out a messaging bill. All they're going to have to do is point to just how bad this is. Now, understand, and this is where Democrats are bad at this stuff. Republicans gave them Project 2025, wrote 900 and some pages of how bad they're going to govern, wrote 900 and some pages on who they're going to attack, what they're going to attack, and how they're going to drag government in a bathtub and drown it. And Democrats didn't use it, didn't get the message out. So if they're still a functional party, this is a massive gift, because there's very little in this that is going to make working people happy. Sure, there's the the headline stuff. Oh, you're not going to pay taxes on your tips. Even though most people don't pay federal taxes on tips anyway because they don't make that kind of money. The no tax on overtime thing, which I don't know this is going to last long because employers are going to lose their mind trying to do the paperwork and the red tape to get through it. Or they just might end overtime, which, or just keep moving towards the gig model to where you don't get overtime anyway. A lot in here that's bad. The Medicaid thing we're gonna see massive pain and suffering. The automatic cuts that are going to come to Medicare. This stuff is not popular. And Democrats, if they've got an they've got an opportunity to use this. And the fact that, remember, Republicans were the ones who told us that we need to have, X amount of time to read the bill. We need to make sure it gets read and we have time to debate and amend and all that. They did this like thieves in the night. And this is one of those things that, Democrats should be pounding them on. But ultimately, the massive tax handouts to the very wealthy and to the corporate interests, that, I got to tell you, that's got to be what gets hammered on. It is still the 99% versus the 1%. And this big, beautiful disaster, this is it. And I never want to hear a conservative or a Republican talk to me about fiscal responsibility. I don't ever want to hear another Republican say that they're fiscally conservative, because then that means you're, look, I'm a tax and spend liberal. I will tell you that. I believe in taxing the very wealthy and using that money to do the things that we need to get done. Roads, bridges, education, healthcare, infrastructure, national defense, all of that stuff needs to be paid for. Not off the backs of the poor, not out of taking food out of the mouths of children, not of cutting veterans' benefits, not of kicking granny out of nursing homes, but by taxing the people who have gotten so, so much over the last 40, 50 years. So I proudly say I am a tax and spend person. I believe we tax the people who have the money and we spend it on the things we want and need. We don't borrow from the future, from our children's future, and we don't steal from poor people to enrich the very wealthy. So don't ever talk to me about fiscal responsibility and have a red hat that you probably bought in China. So for me, this, Democrats, you got a chance. You got a shot. This is the messaging bill of all messaging bills, and you didn't even have to write it. This was a hand-delivered gift, even if it doesn't pass, because this, as all budgets are, moral documents have shown our God-fearing Christian folk to be immoral and in many cases downright evil. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, as I said, big, beautiful bill, my big, beautiful behind. Big, beautiful betrayal. Yeah, I mean, this is, remember, this was supposed to be the administration that was going to care about the working class. These were the folks who were going to, this was the populist uprising, and yet, well, other than the little window dressing and the bumper sticker stuff, working class folks not going to take it on the chin. Our billionaire class, the big, beautiful billionaire bill, that I would have said, yeah, that did a really masterful job there, Republicans. And here to share some thoughts on just how much of a disaster this is going to be for working people, I've asked Daniel Horowitz to come share some thoughts. Daniel's a legislative director over at the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE.org, their website. Daniel, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. Always great to be on the show.
So, as I said, this is a big, beautiful betrayal of working people. Federal workers are front and center on this. How bad is this for your members? Let's start there.
The bill overall is a disaster for all working people. If you look at its impacts, if you look at the cuts to health care and the changes to tax policy, you know, the Congressional Budget Office looked at this recently, and what they found, amazingly, is that people in the bottom tenth of the population actually see their incomes go down as a result of this bill. And of course, people in the upper tenth, their incomes go up. And the higher you are at the top of the cake, the better off you do. But if you look specifically at the effects on federal workers, they're potentially catastrophic. We made some progress on the bill, that's for sure, because there were provisions in there that were too much even for the Republicans to stomach. But if you look at the provisions affecting federal workers, if those became law, the civil service as we know it would cease to exist.
And that is the plan. I mean, ultimately, I said back all during the campaign that this was not about good governance. It wasn't about government efficiency. It wasn't about saving taxpayer dollars or giving a rat's behind about taxpayer dollars or deficits or debt or any of that. This was about making patronage and loyalty to dear leader great again. And I think they, on that front, if you're looking at the loyalty to the billionaires who funded the campaign, I think Trump delivered.
Yeah, I think it was a pretty good investment for them. But for federal workers, it's not a good deal at all. And let's look at some of the specifics here. So two provisions that stayed in reconciliation. The first one affects something that probably most people have not heard of, which is called the FERS supplement. And in a nutshell, this is a bridge to Social Security for federal employees who retire before age 62. But they stand to lose, on average, almost half of their retirement. So an average person who loses this benefit, there are 20,000 people who get this benefit, they stand to be personally contributing $18,000 a year to deficit reduction by virtue of this provision. So that'll pay for some rich person's tax cut. But let's look at the provision that's really going to destroy the civil service. And that gets to this at-will provision that they've put in. This is extraordinary in its daring, what the Republicans have done. So for decades, all the way back to 1978 and earlier, federal workers have had some tenure protection in their jobs in order to insulate them from politicians of both parties and make sure that we have competent experts and workers in the government. And what the Republicans are now saying is, if you want to keep those rights as a new federal employee, you have to pay for them. So instead of contributing the normal 4%, 4.4 to your retirement every year from your pay, if you want to keep your civil service protections, you have to pay 9.4% of your pay every year for your entire career just to access those basic protections that are already in law.
Hold on. Whoa. So, what? Let's start with what?
Abuse of the budget process. They are undoing, really, 150 years of the professional civil service by charging people for their rights.
Well, you know, to be honest, that is probably one of the most Republican things ever. I mean, to be honest, you know, this is about business, and you know, look, it's very Trumpian to get you to pay for things that you're. I can't wait for them to go, well, you know, in order to get your First or Second Amendment rights, well, I mean, I think we're almost there. You're going to have to pay a little extra if you want the all of the rights, a little bit more money.
Yeah, why not? Let's charge for the whole Bill of Rights, and we'll see who can pay. That's the principle here, and it's It's horrifying, actually. But the effect is going to be, over time, nobody's going to be able to pay 10% of their pay to keep their rights. So they're going to have to forfeit their rights. It's brilliant in a way. And in a period of years, the entire civil service will be at will. And if anybody speaks out of line or questions what the president may be doing, they'll be fired. They have no rights at all. The other aspect to this is its absolutely transparent goal is union busting. Because if you have no rights, what can a union offer you? Yeah. What we offer you is a process for accessing your rights. And if you have no rights, why join a union? I wouldn't, perhaps.
Yeah,
other than solidarity.
No, I mean, it's quite remarkable. But again, as I've been saying for the longest time, our billionaire class, the people who are going to wildly enrich themselves because of this. And then I would argue probably plow some of that money back into all of these right-wing think tanks, the state policy networks, all of these groups who pay a lot of money to sit and dream up bad ideas. It's only going to get worse. And here it is. It's their Super Bowl. All these bad ideas are coming to fruition. One of the other things I wanted to ask you about is, you know, a judge just ruled yesterday, the Department of Education, there was supposed to be a whole bunch of layoffs because of an executive order. Evidently, that's been stopped, or I guess the judge has blocked the administration from going forward on these. I assume this is going to end up at the Supreme Court. What do we know here, and what happened?
Well, this is one of many efforts by the Trump administration to illegally close agencies, and it's been done through the DOGE over a period of months, but it's Education Department, USAID that does foreign aid, the Institute of Peace. Many, many agencies have been targeted in this way where they simply show up and say you're all being laid off or you're all put on administrative leave and we're impounding the money. And, you know, judges more often than not have been standing up with us. But as you say, these issues will all ultimately go to the Supreme Court. That's really their plan, where they think they have a leg up. So we'll have to see in the long run what happens. But what I would say is it's so important for congressional Republicans to stand up to what's happening. I know it seems like a tall order at times, but ultimately to defeat some of these horrible ideas, we need Congress to reassert its authority. And if there was a silver lining in what happened on reconciliation, some bad provisions did come out behind the scenes because it was too much for Republicans to stand.
Because eventually they're going to have to go back and look their voters in the eye. Maybe at some point they're going to have to go do a town hall. And maybe somebody might ask, right?
Well, we hope.
But here's the thing. Well, I mean, you guys have been very successful at taking this administration to court. And in most of the cases, being victorious. But here we are again saying, well, you know, it's a temporary win because of the Supreme Court. And I would also argue, I don't think it even matters what the Supreme Court does or says. I think Trump's going to do what he wants anyway.
Yeah, well, we see a lot of that in the immigration realm. Even the Supreme Court, if he doesn't like their decision, of course, he just ignores it. So we'll have to see what happens. But I think what's important now is that reconciliation is horrible. Nothing conciliatory about it. But it's not the last word, and people have to stay engaged in the process. Now it goes to the Senate, it goes back to the House. A lot can happen, both good and bad, during the next several weeks, and we need to continue to fight.
No, absolutely, and you keep hounding on your representatives, because some of them were, you know, a little arm twisting, a lot of pressure from the administration. If you put equal amounts of pressure on them from home, I don't know. I'm not quite sure where their loyalty lies with their constituents or with this administration. So keep hammering on that, because look, you're right. This bill isn't going to look what it looks like today. Once the Senate gets a hold of it, there are already people saying major parts of it need to be rewritten, made better, made worse. We'll see. But it's a lot of bad in this. I mean, you know, top to bottom, outside of you could argue the no tax on tips or overtime, that's in there. But all of the other stuff, not good. The cuts to Medicaid, the cuts to Medicare, the cuts to SNAP, the cuts to, you know, program after program, not great for working people.
Not only those big ticket items that you mentioned, But there are all kinds of sleeper provisions here. We talked about making federal workers at will. There's a provision to make it easier to acquire silencers. Help some assassins out, I guess.
How's that a budget thing?
Well, because they're taxed right now, and they want to eliminate those taxes.
Okay, yeah, mate, we're going to make silencers great again.
And they want to make it harder, actually, in federal court to get these injunctions and so on that have been helping us out by making us pay perhaps huge bond fees in order to access those injunctions. So there's all kinds of hidden things, 1,000 pages long. It was unveiled the very night it was voted on. Nobody knows what's in there.
So let me ask you this, because you're a guy who does this every day in D.C. Weren't Republicans the folks who were telling us we need days to read the bill? Every bill should be read by every member. We need to slow down the process because we'll never do what those Democrats did. Did I miss that?
No, absolutely right. There were a few Republicans who were saying, well, where is our 72 hours to read the bill? But not many, because they are on the clock here, because eventually we're going to run out of room under the debt ceiling, and they don't want to have to involve Democrats, as they should, in bipartisan governance. They want to do it all themselves, so they get their priorities, and that means getting the debt limit raised before we run out of money. So they are rushing this through for sure.
And that's where, you know, I'm not a Rand Paul fan by any stretch of the imagination, but at least he, on that issue, he's been very consistent, saying, look, you know, we got to be more fiscally responsible. And he said, look, if you're going to raise the debt ceiling $4 or $5 trillion, and I said this at the beginning, it indicates that this bill ain't fixing anything.
Yeah. You know, it's hard not to agree with some of the conservatives, because at least they're intellectually honest on some of these issues. And deficit is one. We'll probably disagree on everything they'd like to do to achieve deficit reduction, but at least they're consistent in some respect on that.
Yeah. I mean, for me, the answer in a lot of this is Elon Musk. We should be taxing him and his ilk at a much higher rate, not giving more tax cuts, because, you know, the headline I read was the largest tax cut in the history of humanity, and most of it's going to Musk and his ilk, which they've already got everything, virtually every dollar that is in their pocket in one way or another, and yet we're giving them more. Seems well, doesn't seem right.
No, it's absolutely wrong. And if you look at 40 years of Republican tax policy, the wealth of the upper stratum has gone up something like tenfold. I ran the numbers a few months ago. It's something like $50 trillion in the hands of the tiniest sliver of the population.
Now, I brought up Doge Boy, which seems to be backing out of the political world. I mean, he's taken kind of a beating because, well, nothing he said has been true. I mean, you know, and people are now beginning to realize he's full of it. And even his Twitter account, which used to be, you know, more than, well, I think the Washington Post reported 3/4 of his tweets were about Doge or U.S. politics, now down to about 10%. So he's kind of had this massive shift away because, well, what he said didn't happen. He didn't go in and save $2 trillion or find the Office of Waste, Fraud, and Abuse. All he's done is break things and steal stuff.
Well, that's absolutely right. That's what he did. But look, it's going to take years and decades to repair the damage that he's done. I used to work in the government before I came to AFG. It is extremely hard to hire the highly qualified people that you need for these specialized government functions. Government pay is less than the private sector. The hiring process is complex. There are security clearances, all kinds of things. It's difficult. So when you get somebody good in the government, you do everything you can to keep them. And here we have somebody just coming in, thinking he knows everything, dismissing people right and left. And now we're left with what we're left with. And it's going to take a very long time to repair that. And moreover, difficult because people are so cynical about government. Why would anybody want to join the government when they see what traumas they have just gone through in the last 4 months, and that you can be dismissed for no reason? Why would anybody go through it? So that is going to take a lot of effort to undo.
No, you're absolutely right. And while the stated mission was an abject failure, they did accomplish what Republicans have always wanted to do, and that is break government even further, allowed Grover Norquist and his bots to go drag the government into the bathtub and drown it in the bathtub. We got a lot of work to do, Daniel, but good on you guys. Keep up the fight. I'd love to have you come back and share some more as we get down the road on this. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick. Good to be on the show.
Daniel Horowitz, legislative director there at the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE.org, their website. Want to hear your thoughts. Do we want government small enough that it can be drug into the bathtub and drown? Or do we want, as Daniel said, good qualified people who are going to spend their careers helping we the people? Want to hear it? Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back.
Locally grown radio, WFHR. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy tonight, a low in the upper 30s. For tomorrow, mainly sunny, few clouds around the area, and highs in the mid-60s. And partly to mostly sunny on Sunday and Monday, highs into the upper 60s. Chance of rain on Tuesday, currently 51 degrees.
Breaking sports radio show news coming across the ticker. In a move for the ages, 105.5 WIRI has traded for playmakers. Join us 4 to 5 Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays. Hit us in the numbers by calling with your sports takes and feelings. We'll have James, Randy, Michael, and Seth bringing you local sports coverage and news that you won't hear anywhere else. Thanks to our friends at Quality Plus Printing and Family Natural Foods. Be heard 4 to 5 every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday on 105.5 WIRI's newest roster edition, Playmakers. We speak sports.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Thursday, our petty, petulant president evidently has blocked Harvard's ability to enroll international students in what's being called a major escalation in the administration's effort to pressure the college to fall in line with the agenda. And look, this is another one of those moments where good on Harvard. Look, I'm not in the corner of the elite, but at least someone standing up to this administration in a way that needs to be done. Now, this administration is going to use every level of power to make the example of them. But I think they've got the resources and, well, I think there's some smart people over there who and some legacy there that I think Trump may have, again, run himself into a fight that he's going to have to figure out how to declare victory and move away from at some point. Going to be interesting to see. Now, a federal judge has rightly stopped President Trump's attempt to gut the Department of Education. As you know, the war on education, front and center. But Trump's executive order, which was going to lead to mass layoffs, would have devastated public education by stripping essential services from students and teachers. The judge has stopped. The judge, Meng Jian, responding to a lawsuit from two Massachusetts school districts and AFT, the American Federation of Teachers, ordered the department to rehire all the workers and block further shutdown and layoff efforts. These cuts weren't about efficiency. They were a direct attack on working families in public schools because it's not about what we've learned. There's no care about efficiency or good governance or what even that should look like. It's about attacking perceived enemies and education being part of that. Because look, without the Department of Education, support for special education, financial aid, and civil rights protections, gone, vanished, done. And for many working class families, understand, public education's a lifeline. And as Judge John said, the layoffs threatened irreparable harm, especially for vulnerable students who rely on these vital services. it really was about punishing, and it is about punishing the poor and enriching the... Look at the big budget bill. I mean, this big budget disaster. And I understand. Let's be clear. This wasn't about saving money. This isn't about good governance. This isn't about trying to help public education, which has some problems in places. This was about a massive, enormous shift in power. This was about stripping power away from we the people and we the public towards privatized interest, towards moneyed interest, the for-profit education model that leaves everyday working families behind. This was about enriching them. Because understand, education, still, I still believe it's a right, not a privilege. And this ruling is a win for teachers, yeah, for the people who work at the Department of Education, for students, and for a working class who still believes in strong public education, for strong public schools for everyone. Reality is we need investment in education, not political attacks on it. And that's all this is. That's all Trump is doing, is trying to destroy it so that they can profitize and privatize. And also, in another critical win for working families and people like me who defend public education, the U.S. Supreme Court blocked Oklahoma's attempt to open the country's first taxpayer-funded religious charter school. The court deadlocked 4-4, which meant that the Oklahoma State Supreme Court, their ruling stood, and they ruled that such a school would violate both the state and federal constitution protections against church, the separation of church and state. Interestingly enough, and this is where I know my religious friends are going to lose their mind, because when Justice Amy Coney Barrett was put on the court, everybody I knew said, hey, this is it. We're going to get that wet dream of being able to have religious schools delve their snout into the trough of public dollars. She recused herself. I got to tell you, a huge, huge thing in my view. Because I got to think she would have gone the deciding vote to overturn the lower court ruling, but she recused herself because she's done a lot of work on this front. Now, for working class families, this decision protects the integrity of public dollars going to public education, going to public schools that serve all kids, regardless of faith, regardless of income, regardless of background, regardless of zip code. Look, if we were to allow public funds to be put into the pockets of religious institutions, it would have undermined even the already underfunded public schools, would have threatened to divide communities even more and limit access to truly inclusive education. Now, this is the weird part, because if you were to allow that to go to a Catholic school, charter school, does that mean they can deny Muslim students from going? Yeah, probably. Or people who just don't believe at all. This outcome, major victory. For people who believe, like I do, education should prioritize students, communities, and not religion. Charter schools, while controversial, and I'm against the idea of how they have become, I was in favor of the idea from the start, public schools, do things a little bit differently, share best practices, very teacher, very education-centric. That's not what we got. What we've got is a system that lines the pockets of profiteers, of the latest proprietary education software or curriculum, and drains money out of the public school system. Understand, while public institutions, they have to remain secular. And diverting public dollars to religious programs, that would have really swung the doors wide open to a ton of discrimination. So for me, this is a big win. And folks like the American Federation of Teachers, they hailed this ruling and affirmed that public funds should support public schools that serve the whole community, not just the chosen few. That's the way we go. And I see this as a critical win for defending our local public schools and public schools for all. Because here's the thing. Public education, really, honestly and truthfully, it's the cornerstone of American democracy, a vital institution for working class families, for working class kids. It offers every child, like I said, regardless of income, race, background, zip code, no matter what, offers a chance at a better future. For working class Americans who can't afford private tuition or expensive extracurriculars, you know, having to play sports, seriously? The public education that I got and that a lot of people of my generation got, it's going away. And understand, public education is the primary pathway to upward mobility. Not only provides basic literacy and proficiency, but also critical thinking skills, social skills, civic knowledge, the kind of things that we need to participate in our society and our economy. Yeah, the melting pot idea that I grew up believing in, that happened in public school. And when public schools are adequately funded and equally supported, they serve as that ladder out of poverty that I was able to use and a stabilizing force for communities across this country. But that system, it's under attack. Republicans and school choice Democrats increasingly, you know, falling for these privatization schemes like vouchers or charter schools. And I know I've heard the rhetoric. We just want alternatives. We want choice. You know, charters, we're just going to add some competition because, you know, the underfunded schools, they're going to compete with the privatized schools. And what we know is the choice, the competition sounds nice on paper. In reality, what they do is they undermine public education and are a massive disadvantage for working class students in communities that don't have the base to support two separate systems. What we know, voucher programs redirect public funds from public schools to private and religious schools. We know that's happening. And you can frame it however you want. This is not helping working class families escape failing schools. Vouchers serve wealthy families. People are already sending their kids to private schools. This is a massive windfall for them. Because understand, many of the private schools who get the golden ticket vouchers, they're not held to the same academic standards, the same financial standards, the same accountability standards as your local public school. Different rules. So what we've created almost is a two-tier system where you have resources being drained from the public sector, leaving public schools with fewer funds, fewer opportunities to serve the kids that are there. And you're enriching the already well-to-do at the cost of the greatest disadvantage. Because understand, you know, some charter schools do okay. And again, they operate with limited oversight. And the weird thing is, if you look at the Stanford study, mixed reviews at best. A few do better, most do fairly the same, and a lot do worse. So while charter schools may attract the most motivated students, they don't really get the special needs or the folks who are a little harder to educate. That's left to the traditional public schools. So what you then have is this kind of self-defeating system where these charter schools are creaming off the students who are going to raise your system up and leaving the public school with the kids who are much harder to educate, much more costly to educate. And of course, you know, the undesirables, the ones we don't want, we'll leave over there. Instead of having a community system that we desperately need. Because what we know, and we've seen the stories, we've seen the studies, charter schools frequently engage in tons of exclusionary practices, such as counseling out kids that have behavioral disorders. You know, either you take the Ritalin or, you know, we can't help you. And of course, not providing, you know, services for people with disabilities. This is a massive increase in segregation and inequality, and that's what it's supposed to do. And unfortunately, most working class kids are going to be left behind. Understand, these privatization schemes are not about making education better. as a whole. They're about picking a handful of winners and losers. This fragmented educational landscape is weakening our democratic control of schools. Public schools are accountable to we the people. We elect school boards. Local communities hold them account. Our private schools, our charter schools, no. Very much a dictatorial, fascistic, corporate style of management. Or religious, which takes very little input from you and me and we the people, especially if you don't fall into their narrow line. So what happens when you have a system that has little transparency or community involvement? You get kids who are educated in a very narrow scope. And that should frighten people. Public education is not a consumer product. It's not a consumer product subject to market forces. It's a public good, and it's there for all of us. It's a benefit for everyone, not just those who are directly getting education now or coming. All of us. Strong public schools mean safer neighborhoods, higher employment, more informed citizens. Let me say that again. More informed citizens. And what do you have on the other side when working class kids are denied access to a fully funded, high quality public education? We know what happens. It exacerbates all of the negatives, all of the inequality, all of the crime, the broken families, all of that. And it narrows this country's future potential. So instead of diverting public funds into private schemes, what we need are policymakers who are going to stand up and strengthen public education for everybody, not just the winners. And this means investing in teachers. This means expanding support services. This means ensuring equitable funding, even in poor districts. For working class Americans, for people like you and me, public education isn't just a service. It's the lifeline. It's the opportunity. It's that way that our kids are going to have that better future that we want for them. And undermining it threatens not only our kids' future, but the fabric of this country. Understand, to destroy public education is to attack the heart of our functioning democracy. And I would argue with surgical precision. The people who are doing this, they know exactly what they're doing and why. And for the diabolically inclined, this isn't madness. This is the strategy. This is what they've been dreaming of. This is what they pay a lot of money to smart people to sit in their think tanks and dream up. Because they know when public education is robust and well-funded, it empowers we the people, the masses, with knowledge, with critical thinking skills, a sense of shared civic responsibility. The idea that we the people engage in this wonderful experiment of self-governance. Yeah, they don't want that. What did George Carlin say? What do the owners not want? A well-educated, well-informed populace of critical thinking, capable of critical thinking and making decisions. No, they want well-trained workers. People just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork, but not smart enough to ask why. Understand, an ignorant populace is easy to control. And undermining education, what it does is it fragments truth, replaces history with propaganda, and it turns future generations into what? Obedient workers, rather than people who are willing to question. And you ask, well, why would they do that? Look around. Why would someone want to do it? Clear. Power. Wealth. And, well, a system of hierarchy that's immune to merit. These are the people who talk about meritocracy, and yet, where you were born and where your lineage is much more important than your work ethic. Yet these are the people who tell us that they believe in pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, only we're going to steal your bootstraps. What they also know is an educated populace demands accountability. The miseducated, well, they can be distracted with spectacle. Look at this administration. They can be distracted by a spectacle, divided by fear, and pacified with misinformation. Hello, Red Hat. Slashing school funding, demonizing teachers, privatizing our institutions. These aren't random acts, but calculated moves to dismantle the one system that threatens the supremacy of our elite. So for every shuttered library, every underpaid teacher, every standardized test becomes a weapon in a war against intellectual independence. Us. And to destroy public education is to poison the wellspring of equality, of opportunity. And what we do when that happens is we ensure that the well-to-do, the well-lineaged, the well-funded, they're going to get all the knowledge that they need, the opportunity that they can get. And well, the rest of us, we're screwed. But what we're seeing on this education front, this is in essence a slow, deliberate coup, not with guns or bombs, but with ignorance as the chosen instrument of domination. And it is working. Thank goodness for the courts at this point, but I fear that our Supreme Court at some point gives them the wins they want. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. These education rules, do you think they're going to hold? And are we ready yet to say we want that strong public education, that strong school district in our neighborhood that invites everyone and gives opportunity to everyone equally? Are we ready for that? I want to hear your thoughts. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 2003. That was the day that the U.S. Senate approved more than $300 billion in tax cuts over the next decade. The cuts barely passed. Vice President Dick Cheney cast the deciding vote 51-50. Starting in 2001, President George W. Bush proposed and pushed for a series of drastic tax cuts. The administration promised the changes would help to create jobs and grow the economy. But the results fell far short of that goal. 10 years after the massive tax cuts, the Washington Post ran a story analyzing their impact. The article stated, quote, "By any measure, the Bush tax cuts have benefited the wealthy more than the middle class. The top 20% of earners received 73% of the tax relief. The bottom 20% only received 1%. Coupled with spending on wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the tax cuts sent the national debt soaring. And those promised jobs? They never materialized. 2001 to 2007 marked the worst period of job growth since the 1950s. Then, in 2008, the recession wiped out 8 million jobs. Many of the Bush tax cuts were designed to sunset or expire after so many years. Yet, when it came time for the cuts to end in 2010, Republicans in Congress fought to keep them going. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka declared, "It is absolutely insane that in these tough economic times, some people want to continue George W. Bush's tax giveaways to millionaires. Working families are losing their jobs, their benefits, and their homes. They are the ones who need help." The Bush tax cuts finally expired in 2013, although new legislation repackaged and continued many of them. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So as I said earlier with Daniel Horowitz, Elon evidently is backing up, and wow, how quickly he's kind of disappeared from the political spectrum. Because, you know, earlier this year, according to the Washington Post, as many as 75% of Elon Musk's posts on X were about Doge or politics of some sort, of which he was taking a position. That number, they say, has fallen to 10% as he has evidently gone back to posting about battery technology and AI. And look, AI, the big winner for him. I would argue he didn't get into to government and to Doge because he wanted to help you or me. No, he was in it for himself. I have nothing but but suspicion for Elon Musk. The fact that he has all this information, we don't know. We have no idea what he got, what he grabbed. No idea whatsoever. We have no idea how much of our information is in his hands in what was really just a massive smash and grab. But the fact that he's now pulling back tells me that he got what he wanted, which was in this big, beautiful disaster of a bill, evidently a decade of no states being able to regulate AI. That's enormous, especially from the people who tell us they believe in states' rights. You know, we're tenthers, except on the AI front, which Elon will be a huge part of controlling. And again, back to what we just talked about education. AI is just destroy every teacher I know, every professor. AI is just a nightmare because it's easy. Write my paper for me and AI spits it out for you. No critical thinking, no learning how to do research, none of that. And as I've said for a long time, the one thing that came out of the pandemic that's most frightening to me is all the people going, you got to do your own research. And their belief that research means watching some idiot YouTube video while on the can with their mouth open, drooling. Yeah, that's not research. That's not testing your hypothesis or any of that. That's just regurgitating something that some other idiot put on the internet. This is frightening stuff. But I have hope, and this is where I want to end. I have hope that we are going to find each other, that out of what is coming, and we know bad things are coming, that we will find each other. Axios did a story on Thursday that caught my attention that it said Americans support unions over big business. Shocking. By a record margin is what they're saying. For the first time, this is the highest in 60 years that people are saying, you know what? Labor unions are a good thing. Private corporations, you know, big business, not so good, which is why you're seeing so many Republicans pretending. Like they care about union workers now. The whole Trump thing is amazing to me because look at what Trump is actually doing to union workers. Look at the assaults on federal workers right now. Because understand, if you're carrying a union card today, that's your future. Unless, and this is where I had a very interesting conversation recently with a historian friend of mine, who said, what do you think? And I said, well, I think at some point it is possible that a union leader, maybe my union's leader, will be the next Richard Ley. There were unions in Nazi Germany. When Hitler did away with all the independent unions, you had the Democratic Labor Front. You had one big, beautiful union. Granted, they weren't independent. Granted, they didn't really fight for working people. And everybody had to be in them. But they were in a union. They didn't make lives better. They were more of a controlling feature for a dictator. They didn't really stand up. They didn't stand up to the dictator. So the idea of unions, I'm a union guy, but I'm an independent union guy. I believe in unions fighting the good fight, standing up for the working folks who are struggling to put food on the table or struggling to hold on to their rights. But I'm looking at the potential of a future where, yeah, Republicans will support unions as long as they're meant to keep people in line, not to keep people fighting for more of the economic pie. Or for a better future, or for public education, or for opportunity. Yeah, I can see a Republican-led labor movement, but it's not a good one, and it's not going to be good for us. And I can see a labor leader stepping forward and being the head of that. It's not good for us. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick.
at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. President Trump today uttered his favorite word and tanked the markets.
President Trump singled out Apple in a social media post, but in the Oval Office clarified he's putting a 25% tariff on all foreign-made smartphones.
It would be also Samsung and anybody that makes that product.
As he signed executive orders on nuclear power plants, the president also pledged 50% trade tariffs on imported goods from the European Union.
It was formed in order to hurt the United States, in order to take advantage of the United States.
And echoing his social media statements, Trump said products made in the U.S. will face zero tariffs. Linda Kenyon, CBS News, the White House.
Boeing has avoided criminal prosecution over the deadly crashes of two 737 MAX planes about 6 years ago.
The Department of Justice and Boeing have entered into a non-prosecution agreement.
It's beyond the sweetheart deal.